Okay, so first, if by any chance you're mentally impaired this morning, you can get a review of this in more concentrated form at a Earthscope Imaging Science and CIG Seismology Workshop, which is going to be at Washington University, St. Louis, at the end of October. And it's going to concentrate on imaging methods and forward modeling methods. And the idea is that it's only a three-day workshop, but there will be a day and a half of tutorials and a day and a half of presentations. It'll be announced on the IRIS and CIG web pages shortly. And this is the third imaging science workshop and the second CIG seismology working group workshop. And we decided to combine them this year to concentrate on the forward modeling methods, which I hope you'll see is an essential part of an imaging method. So the outline of this is, I first want to build on what Ann talked about the other day on receiver functions, and she talked about common conversion point stacking. I want to compare that to scattered wave imaging, and then talk about Born scattering, which is equivalent to single scattering, and then an example of a diffraction integral, which leads to Kirchhoff depth migration, talk about some limitations, show some examples. And if time permits, which I doubt, I can explain the difference between inversion and migration. And then your tutorial can be downloaded from this, and it's also on the tutorial question sheet, which I emailed out a little while ago. Did anybody check their email in the last 20 minutes? Anyway, you should get it shortly. So for motivation, I wanted to show this seismic reflection profile, which is from the Canadian Lithoprobe program, and like all seismic programs, it has a nice acronym. It's SNORCL, which stands for Slave Northwest Canadian Lithosphere Experiment, I think. And they did a conventional reflection survey. But they let their vibrators run a long time, and they let their recording instruments run a long time, and they actually can see down, I guess I cut off the scale here, but they can actually see down about 120 kilometers, or a little over 100 kilometers. And the MOHO is right here. All the nice colored stuff is the crust, and what's below it is the mantle, and the MOHO is, you know, reasonably flat. There isn't too much topography on it across here. And this section shows a lot of interesting things. The reflection section shows that mountain belts are built by thrust faulting, and you see lots of nice thrust faulting even in the lower crust, which shows that if you have high strain rates, you can get thrust faults or discrete faulting events in the lower crust rather than flow. And the other thing that it captured, though, was a bit of oceanic crust, which is subducting to the northeast underneath Canada back in the Proterozoic. This origin is Proterozoic in age, and the slave provinces are Archean. And this oceanic crustal layer they can trace down to about 80 kilometers. And they also see a lot of other mantle reflections down here. And it looks to them, they've interpreted this as a series of oceanic slabs which were subducting underneath a proto-continent in the Archean and stacked up and built up what we now call the tectosphere, at least a Proterozoic tectosphere. And it's, you know, there's a number of good papers on the models. And in fact, Adrian Lenardic and Katie Cooper did some geodynamic modeling to show what the range, what kind of range of parameters you would have that would make this a stable process. But what's real interesting about it is there was also a teleseismic array out at Yellowknife right here. And the Yellowknife array data was turned into receiver functions, and the receiver functions see some of these small events. So you see this event right here, which in the reflection section is less than a kilometer thick, shows up very nicely as a converted wave in the receiver function. And then this dipping event from the what was the subduction zone is also seen down here. And they've tentatively identified these as different possible discontinuities from classic seismology. But the reflection data is got a dominant frequency of about 20 hertz, and the receiver function data has a dominant frequency of about 5 seconds. And so you have an extremely broad bandwidth that's seeing the same things. And this suggests that you can see fairly fine details in the mantle from in receiver function images. Now, you know, the reflection data says that this thing is, you know, a few hundred meters or less than a kilometer wide, and you would have a hard time interpreting how thick that is from how thick that event is, but it's being produced by the same thing. And they attribute the receiver function signal as coming from a layer of anisotropy, a very thin layer of anisotropy between two plates. Okay, so so conventional receiver function imaging relies on a layered model, and the signal that you want is this one shown in red here. So you have a P wave come in and it converts to an S wave here, and you record it at your station right here, and you assume you have a plane interface. So this could be the MOHO, or it could be the 410 or the 660, or any other continuous interface. Now you have a problem at the crust in that you have a very large velocity contrast, and you have all these other waves that come in and convert and arrive behind your direct signal. So you have different paths which have multiple P or multiple S paths. And your signal, once you've processed it to produce a receiver function, shows a direct wave, your MOHO signal, which is this one, and then these various other multiple reflected phases. And these usually show up between 10 and 20 seconds after the time of P on the receiver function. And they contaminate a part of the upper mantle that we're very interested in. Unfortunately, there's not a good solution to that yet. I'd like to say there was, but there's not. And for the most part, the size of the signal you get is sensitive to shear velocity perturbations. Now, there's another way of looking at this, and that's looking at scattered waves rather than a wave that's converted at what we would call a specular interface. And there's two classes of scattered wave imaging systems. One is called an incoherent imaging system, and these are frequency and amplitude sensitive, and the most common example is photography. You know, frequency is color, and amplitude is color saturation. Another example is military sonar. They're interested in where submarines are, so they send out a signal, and then they look at the energy that comes back, and they say, aha, I see a submarine. Some deep crustal reflection seismology in the old days was done this way because the data quality wasn't very good and our algorithms weren't very good. And the Sumatra earthquake sourced by Miyake Ishii and Peter Scheer and John Vidali is an example of incoherent energy imaging because they looked at the amplitude of energy as a function of time. And so each frame of their movie is an incoherent image. Coherent imaging uses phase coherence, and so it's sensitive to frequency, amplitude, and phase. And examples are medical ultrasound imaging. Everyone's seen an ultrasound image of a fetus. That's a coherent image. Military sonar. The Navy is not only interested if there is a submarine, it wants to know if it's coming toward them or away from them. Presumably, if it's going away from you, that's better than if it's coming toward you. And so they also look at the Doppler shift in the frequencies and look at the phase, and they can tell which direction the submarine's moving in. And the last one is exploration seismology, and by that I mean oil industry seismology or crustal seismology. And it's a big field in the oil industry. About 90% of the money spent looking for oil is spent on exploration seismology before you drill. A well costs somewhere between $20 and $200 million. And up until the point where you start drilling, 90% of the money goes into this. And there's a nice book on these different classes of imaging by Blackledge called Quantitative Coherent Imaging. So the reason we want to do this is because we get much better resolution with scattered wave imaging. And for looking at the mantle, earthquakes are the only thing we can use that's inexpensive to investigate it. Now you can set off big explosions, but they're very expensive and environmentally insensitive, and people don't like you to do it in a lot of places, so it's hard to get permits. Scattered wave imaging provides about an order of magnitude better resolution than travel time tomography. So the resolution scales for a scattered wave image is the wavelength divided by 2, whereas for tomography, it's the wavelength times the path length, or the distance the waves travel, square root. And so if you just use a wavelength of 1 and 100 wavelengths, you get a resolution in the scattered wave image, theoretically, of 0.5 versus a tomography of about 10. So it's about 20 times better resolution, which means you can see something presumably 20 times smaller. So, and this sort of leads to Fresnel zones. And people talk about Fresnel zones and banana donuts and wave paths, and the basic idea is that waves have finite frequency and they sample a finite volume of space. And so if you have a path from here to here, and that's R, and you a wave is also sampling in an ellipse around this central ray, and the ellipse around the central ray can be divided into zones where the energy adds up at this point either constructively or destructively. So the first Fresnel zone is defined by this path length plus the wavelength over 2, which shifts the wave from in phase to out of phase, and that's greater than or equal to these two other paths. This path R1, R2, or this path R1, R2, and this equation defines an ellipse, so it fills it in. So the first Fresnel zone is the area that the wave samples in phase, and it's this ellipse around a central ray. Now you can make the ray bend, and you just get a bent ellipse around the ray, and that's why it's called a banana, so like a banana donut. And you can do the same thing if you just look down. So let's suppose we have receiver array across the top here, and we have a wave emanating from this point right here. Excuse me, then the Fresnel zone is given by the depth times the wavelength plus the wavelength squared over 4, and the Fresnel zone for something at S2 is R2, which is this distance right here, and from S1 is R1, which is this distance right there. So all this is saying is the waves sample a finite volume, and what scattered wave imaging does is it tries to take this finite volume into account. And there's a nice description of this in a book on sound transmission in the ocean by Stanley Flatey. So Fresnel zone increases with depth and with period. So this is I did this for something we were doing when we were talking designing US Array. And the notion is we have a bunch of point scatterers in the Earth from near the surface down to about 1,000 kilometers. And then I propagated S waves up from through PREM. And this is what you would record at the surface from single sources. And it's isotropic wave, so you don't see any phase shift. And you just get a bunch of hyperbolic looking events. And the Fresnel zone can be seen as the distance between the first peak to the first trough as you go laterally across one of these events. So from here, if that's the central one, this is the first peak, and you go out here to the first trough, and that's roughly the first Fresnel zone. This is at a depth of over 800 kilometers. So the total Fresnel zone is actually, the Fresnel zone is usually given in half units, so it's be half of this total distance. This is an event from the 660, and this is a 15-second wave, so the Fresnel zone here is about 300 kilometers. Now, the notion behind scattered wave imaging is we have a wave comes in and hits an obstacle, just a point, and it scatters off in all directions. So instead of just looking at the central ray, we look at all the rays. And the Fresnel zone, say, would be this big at the surface. And what we want to do is we want to depropagate the field that's recorded up here and carry it back to here. So we could depropagate it this far, and that would collapse the Fresnel zone to a smaller distance. And we could propagate it further and further until we get down to the point. And when we get down to the point, this equation for Fresnel zone goes to lambda over 2, and that gives you your resolution criteria if you capture the first Fresnel zone, if that's all you're depropagating. So if you take this synthetic example and you depropagate it using an accurate velocity model, you get a series of points. And that's and the points have the width, both vertically and horizontally, of the wavelet that you see on here, or the actual seismic signal. And that's the best resolution you can get. So you see this little wavelet here, 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 here. This would be the 660, and that's the 410. So the reason that you would want to do scattered wave imaging rather than just straight receiver functions is because the scattered wave imaging not only collapses things really small, it also restores dips. So the dips that you see are in what is termed a migration or a scattered wave image are true dips. So this is a model of the Japan subduction zone. The model is shown here in blue and red. And these are CCP stacks of the synthetic data set from a bunch of different incidence angles. And what you see is that the dip here is shallower than the dip here, and this is a common problem with CCP stacking. You see the 410 very nicely because it's flat, and the 660 very nicely because it's flat, but you don't actually get a very clear image of the slab. And you also, and I'll talk about this model a little bit more later. But this is a synthetic in which we've done scattered wave imaging using a fairly exact 2D model. And when I say exact, I mean we took the original model and smoothed it and then used that for the imaging. And you can see it fits the velocity model perfectly and restores the dips. And this is with just with the average 1D model. And even with the average 1D model, you get quite a good fit to the model that you started with. So you don't have to put a slab in to get a slab back. The color, the color is the velocity model of the slab. And then you also see some nasty things here, which are slab multiples, and those are waves which come up, convert the slab, go to the surface, come down, reflect off the top of the slab, and they get trapped. And you actually see these in real life. And in the 1D model, there's a slight mismatch between the imaged slab and the true slab in velocity, but it's actually pretty minor. So we want to use receiver functions because it approximately isolates the SV wave from the P wave, and it reduces a vector system to a scalar system, which makes things simple. If you work with vector systems, you have all this really annoying notation that you have to keep track of. And it allows us to use scalar imaging equations for P and S, which we calculate separately. And Barbara, one of the things Barbara mentioned in her lecture last week was that you can describe the P field as the gradient of the scalar potential, and you can describe the SV field as the curl of a vector potential, but it turns out that curl only has one non-zero component, so it's basically two scalar equations. So we get to work with two scalar equations if we use receiver functions rather than a vector equation. So if we want to make an imaging algorithm, we have to have three things. We have to have a scattering model, we have to have a wave depropagator, and we have to have something called a imaging condition, which is what we use to focus the image. And I'm going to talk about each of these in turn. The wave depropagators, there's quite a few different methods. One is diffraction integrals. This is classic. And there's a paper by Wilson, 2003. I guess I got distracted? Something. Anyway, there's a paper on by Wilson, 2003, and the images I show you are diffraction integrals, and I'm going to develop these because I find them most intuitive. There's one-way and two-way finite difference operators, and the Stanford exploration seismology group is famous for these. And there's generalized radon transforms, which Michael Bostock has developed for this kind of problem. And then there's Fourier transforms in space or time with phase shifting. Now, because a lot of the stuff developed in the exploration industry, there are hundreds and hundreds of references here. The Wilson paper and the Bostock paper are for the teleseismic problem. Okay, so let's start off real simply. And first we want to assume that the Earth is very smooth. There's no heterogeneity that is sharp. So there aren't really any boundaries, there's just gradients. And we want to define our wave operator as L. So L is just this thing that moves waves around. It can do it on a grid, it can do it in your mind. It's just an idea, okay? So L, if you apply L to a function G, and you, well, okay, let me start on the other side. Let's apply a unit force in space and time. Does everybody know what a delta function is? Does anybody not know what a delta function is? Okay, a delta function, if someone comes up and punches you in the face very quickly, that's a delta function. It's localized in space, it's localized in time, and there's an operator that will describe what will happen to your face, and what happens to your face is G. Okay, so G is the response, L is the operator that translates this punch into something, and L is the differential equation. So if you Fourier transform a delta function in frequency and space, it comes out to be 1. That's just a nice property. And if we think of these things as matrices, that says that the Green's function, the response to the impulse, is the inverse of the wave operator. It's a very simple idea. So if we have a general source, which we'll describe as S omega, where S is omega's frequency, and we're again going to assume a delta function in space, then we can write U as the inverse operator of S, or U as the Green's function times the source function. So if you have an extended time source, somebody hits you in the face repeatedly, then if you apply G to that, that describes U. And this L here, yeah, it's not elastic anymore. They have to include Q factors. And also there's fluid flow. Sooner or later there will be fluid flow. Okay, so next we want to talk about our scattering model. And the scattering model is the Born approximation. So what we do is we have this really smooth velocity field and we perturb it. You know, we just make something change very quickly. And so the velocity C goes to C plus DC, and the operator L goes to L plus DL, and the field goes to U plus DU. And this is equal to our extended source. So if you expand this thing out, you find that, you know that L times U is equal to the source. And if you keep terms only in order delta, you find that the wave operator applied to the perturbed field is equal to minus the perturbed operator applied to the original field. So this means that if you can get a solution for U, you can get a solution for delta U. And then delta U is just the inverse wave operator applied to the perturbed wave operator times U. And the perturbed wave operator is just an operator whose coefficients have been perturbed a little bit. Okay, so now let's be a little bit more specific, because not everybody understands what the operators mean. So let's use a scalar wave equation that looks like this, and let's just let the velocity field vary, and let's not let the density field vary, because it makes the equation simpler, and for illustration, I think it's better to do this. You get to drop all sorts of terms. So we'll let the velocity field go to a smooth field plus a rough field, and our wave field, which we're trying to calculate, goes to a smooth field plus a rough field, or a perturbed field. So delta U is the perturbed field. And if you just go through the algebra, what you find is that the solution for delta U is a wave equation. So our wave operator over here is del squared. L would be del squared minus del squared plus d2 dt2 times 1 over c squared. So that's just L. And everybody knows what del squared is, right? If you don't know what del squared is, raise your hand. Excellent. Okay, so then the wave operator L times U is equal to DL, and DL, it turns out, is just 2 delta C over C cubed times D2 DT2. So you take the second derivative of the smooth field, and you scale it by this thing, and that is essentially an effective source for the scattered wave field. So your total field then consists of two parts. It consists of this part, which is L times U is equal to your deltas, and it's equal to this part, which is DL times, L times delta U is equal to DL times U. So first you solve this, and then you substitute that into that, and you get the scattered field, then you put them together. And it's the scattered field that we want to use for imaging. The downside of the Born approximation is it doesn't conserve energy, but that never bothers anybody in wave theory. So, now, we're talking about a PSV system, and I just showed you a scalar wave system. In the PSV system, the scattering function looks like this. And so, you have a P wave that comes in, say it comes in vertically, and it hits some obstacle which has a perturbation delta beta and delta rho. And it also has a perturbation delta alpha. So the compressional velocity is perturbed, the shear velocity is perturbed, and the density is perturbed. And your scattering function ends up looking like this. And d zeta is the shear impedance. Impedance is resistance to motion, and that's just density times velocity. And so it's a function of the normalized impedance and the normalized shear velocity times some angular factor, so that means that the wave scatters out at different angles according to the direction that you're looking at the scattering object. So it's actually kind of a complicated function and much more complicated than the scalar equation, but you can, it's relatively easy to code. So what do I mean by a smooth model versus a rough model? So let's take one of the 1D reference models. So this is an S-velocity reference model. And it's actually not a smooth model. And then let's add 5% fluctuation around it, and that would be this red thing. And 5% fluctuation in shear is considered a reasonable upper mantle fluctuation. In fact, as large as 10 is reasonable. And so a smooth model, actually, we would take out these, on the black line here, we would take out the corner, and we would take out the step here and the step here, and you end up with something that's very gradual, like this. And then your rough model would be the perturbations around it. Now, this isn't a very realistic rough model. I just applied a random number series and scaled it appropriately for that. But these actually are measurements, models that came from measurements of PNE data. PNE data stands for peaceful nuclear explosion, which is an oxymoron if ever there was an oxymoron. And this was a series of seismic experiments done over Eurasia by the Soviet Union, and they produced just absolutely beautiful data. And you can do all sorts of scattering calculations. So this model has a perturbed crust. This is S and this is P. This model has a perturbed crust and a gradient. This one has the German Schlieren model, which is these long laminar bodies right underneath the MOHO, which extend just through the upper mantle, and that would be this. This model has something below about 100 kilometers, which is perturbed at a scale of about 5 kilometers, and that would be this perturbation here. And this one has a combination, and Nielsen et al. Compared these in the data and came up with what they thought was the best model. All of these have been proposed to explain various aspects of the scattered field. Now, we want to know if our scattered field's actually big enough to be seen relative to other waves which are on our seismogram, and so this is that equation I showed you for the PSD scattering coefficient as a function of angle. So we're looking at waves that are scattering in the same direction as a P wave, and that's called forward scattering. And the forward scattering lobes are the big ones up here. So the wave's coming in at zero, and this is the amplitude going out. And the black is for the MOHO, so I took a MOHO contrast and calculated these. The blue is for the 660, which produces a nice big signal. And we know we can see those in receiver functions. And then the two reds are for contrast between a fertile mantle, a lyrsolite, and an eclogite, say, so a subducted oceanic crust, which we might be interested in seeing. And what you see is they produce signals which are small, but only half as small as the 660. And we can see the 660 very clearly, so it seems to me we should be able to see these. Oh, and at the bottom is just the specular coefficients as a function of angle for the P to S conversion. So the MOHO produces a large amplitude signal, and the 660 about half. And these scale pretty similarly to these, which they should, because if you integrate the scattering coefficient, you come up with the same equation. Now, next we need to define what we mean by an image. And in this case, we want to define our image as a P to S conversion coefficient, because we're looking at an S wave that's been scattered from a P wave. And so we take the S field that's scattered and divide it by the P field that's incident on it. And if we can do this at some point near X, some subsurface point, and then apply some kind of shaping filter, that gives us a P to S coefficient at some place in the subsurface, which we'll call the image. And this is from a book on seismic imaging. Now, recall from Ann Sheehan's lecture the definition of the receiver function, and that's just the Fourier integral of the SV component over the P component times the shaping filter. So this thing, but it's recorded at the surface. So this is at the receiver, XR, XR. So this thing actually looks very much like this thing. And all we have to really do is take the receiver function and depropagate it so it's at X, and that gives us out our image, and apply, you know, a shaping filter. So the shaping filter for this image we'll just use as the shaping filter for the receiver function. And the only trick now is to take the SV field and the P field and take them from the surface down into the subsurface. So let's look at a specific depropagator, and that's a diffraction integral. And we'll start with our two wave equations, two scalar wave equations. So this one is a homogeneous equation, and this is our Green's function equation, which has the impulse force. And we Fourier transform them to time, so we get equations which go del squared plus k squared u equals 0. So del squared plus k squared is now our wave operator. And k is the wave number, and that's equivalent to the frequency divided by the velocity. And it's a spatial equivalent of frequency. And Green's function 1, now we've gotten rid of the time, and we just have this spatial derivative. So now we use something called a representation theorem. And this is actually the part of the lecture I thought I might throw out, because I don't expect anybody to understand a representation theorem. This just comes from calculus. And it says if you apply one field against another, the Laplacian of another field, and subtract off sort of the reverse thing, and integrate it over the whole volume of a space, then that's equal to recordings that you make on the surface. So this is a surface integral around your volume, and this is the field inside the volume. Now, we know one thing. We have a recorded field. So we'll call the recorded field U. We don't have the Green's function, but we can calculate the Green's function. And so knowing a field and calculating a field, we can predict the field anywhere inside the volume, as long as we know it on the surface. So the first thing we do is use the sifting property of the 3D delta function, and that allows us to identify the field at the surface that we record, and that's equal to this surface integral, or rather the field in the body is equal to this surface integral. And this thing is a very nice expression, and it forms a basis of a lot of diffraction theory. And basically it says that if you know the field U, if you measure it somehow, and you estimate the Green's function, you can predict the field U anywhere inside of a volume. So your volume might be the Earth, say, and you have measurements over the surface of the Earth. So we need a Green's function, and if we just let the velocity be absolutely constant with no variation anywhere, it's just given by this expression. So this is the free space Green's function. It's just the delta function with time retarded by the distance the wave travels divided by the velocity. And then it has this amplitude term, which causes it to decay as 1 over the distance it goes. And this is a 3D Green's function. Now you can write an asymptotic form of this Green's function for a variable velocity medium just as an amplitude term times the delta function, where instead of using the distance divided by the velocity, you use this tau term. And the tau is just the distance divided by the velocity, but now the distance is along a ray path that bends in the Earth. And if you Fourier transform that into time, or into frequency rather, that's just an amplitude term times an exponential term with this phase, e to the I omega tau. So it's the travel time gets converted into a phase term. So both of the amplitude and the phase terms are well known in seismology. The gradient of the travel time field is 1 over the velocity anywhere in the Earth. So it's called the Eikernal equation. And the amplitude term solves something called a transport equation, which is a little less well known, but it gives you geometric amplitudes. And the solution is referred to as a high frequency or asymptotic solution, and Barbara actually talked about this last week. And both of these equations are solved numerically, and you can do, there's a lot of different types of numerical solutions. One thing you can do is just finite difference your velocity field. John Vidali popularized methods like that. Or the other is you can trace rays. And then the amplitudes fall out. So we want a Green's function that vanishes on the surface, or one whose derivative vanishes on the surface. And so we choose what's called an image source, and that's two Green's functions. One, here's your surface, one's above the other. The waves are propagating away from them. They come to the surface and they exactly cancel each other out. Or we can take the derivative and have the derivative cancel each other out. And if you use that, this difference, then you get that dgdn is equal to 2 times the free surface Green's function, where n is the derivative normal to the surface. And this is exact for a flat surface, and it's approximately true if the surface is slowly undulating, and the Earth's surface really is fairly slowly undulating for most seismic waves. Until you get up around 1 hertz or higher, it's slowly undulating. Okay, so The diffraction integral, so basically we got rid of one of the terms in the diffraction integral. What I'm trying to do is save computer time, so I'm trying to get rid of as many terms as I can. So I got rid of one of the terms in the diffraction integral, and I'm left with this. Using that Green's function, I have this amplitude term plus I omega A times d tau dn times the field I observe, and then this exponential. This term is very slowly varying, so I throw it away. That's called a far field approximation. It only changes rapidly if you're right next to your source. So that gives us this thing, which is called the Rayleigh-Sommerfeld diffraction integral. And this is used for diffraction calculations, but if you make the Green's function run backwards instead of forwards, it's also used for imaging. So you can make your waves propagate any way you want. If you have a point source, the waves propagate out, right? And they form spherical shells, or you see this front moving out. You can also, there's also a Green's function that makes them run back in. And so we use that Green's function and make the waves go backwards. And so we can backpropagate the wave field rather than forward propagate it, and that's an imaging integral if we add an imaging condition. And the imaging condition is very simple. It just says that the time when your experiment started is equal, for our case, the time that your experiment started is equal to the time that the S wave took to go from the scattering point to the observation point, plus the time that the P wave took to go from the earthquake to the scattering point. So there's two paths. The earthquake starts here, the P wave propagates here, scatters here, the S wave goes up there. So you take that whole time and you subtract off the two path times, and that means that's when your image would be focused. So the P wave and the S wave would coincide at that point. Is that clear? This was like something that went on in the literature for about 5 years, what constitutes an imaging condition. Very interesting. Okay, so this gives us our integral. Our diffraction integral now looks like this. We get this cosine term from that derivative of the travel time field, and we have our imaging condition here where the time is equal to tau p plus tau sub s. And what we want is something that looks like this integral, which is our imaging integral, which has usv over up. And here we just have u in this one amplitude term. And so we can write the scattering coefficient as the ratio of the amplitude of the S wave to the amplitude of the P wave, and just rearrange this integral a little bit to account for the fact that one of our paths is P and the other path is S. And that gives us this. And this is actually the imaging equation. So this is the geometry now. You have your wave coming in. You're recording it at all these little triangles up here on top of the surface. This is the normal. It's positive down, positive z is your volume. And this image is defined in this volume for recordings that are made along this surface when you scale them by the S amplitude, the P amplitude, a few other factors, and then this phase term. And then a few other little terms that just fall out of the algebra. So this is the travel time grid for an array of stations between 74 and 86 degrees away. This is the P travel time field as a function of depth and travel time in seconds here. So it's around this between 620 to 740 seconds for arrivals between the surface and 800 kilometers. So this is a travel time table that's a function of space, lateral coordinate, and depth. And this is a similar travel time, solution of the Eichner equation for the S field. In depth, this time depth goes this way. I didn't plot this very well, but let's see. Depth goes that way, the surface goes this way, and time is this way. So you go from 200 seconds to 0 seconds. So if you have, let's say we have a scattering point in here someplace. If we want to make an image, we go and we get the time and amplitude and angle from that point, and we go and get the time and amplitude and angle from the equivalent point in here, and we sum them together and put in the right things in the integral, and we do the integral, and that gives us an image at the point. And then we repeat that for every station that we have. And as Anne pointed out, we tend to use waves to do receiver functions between about 30 and 90 degrees because they don't interact with the core, and they're actually more than 30, let's say 45. Between 45 and 90 degrees, because they don't interact with the core and they're not complicated by the by triplications from the transition center. And then we would make an image, say, in this entire gray space right here, down to 800 kilometers or 16, or actually however deep you want to go. You can go down to the core mantle boundary if you feel like it. So this just puts some limitations on what you can do with this stuff. The Fresnel zone is the target depth times the wavelength square root, and there's this thing called spatial aliasing, which I hope you're going to learn about in your tutorial today, if I set it up properly. And that just says that you... Does everybody know what aliasing is? Who does not know what aliasing is? Everybody does? Oh, great. Okay. So, the spatial aliasing... Okay, aliasing means if you have a sine wave, you have to sample that sine wave 2 times per period, or you can't reconstruct it. If you sample it 2.1 times per period, you can reconstruct it. If you sample it 2.2 times per period, you can. If you sample it 1,000 times, you can. But if you go to 1.9, you can't. Because at 1.9, the sine wave begins to look like a lower frequency wave. So it's masquerading as something else, which is why it's called aliasing. It masquerades as a lower frequency. So there's temporal aliasing, which is in time, but there's also spatial aliasing in space. So you have to record your wave field densely enough that you get 2 samples per second, per wavelength along a horizontal surface, your recording surface. And so your sampling interval then, delta x, is equal to beta min over 2 times the maximum frequency you want times sine theta. And f max sine theta is the horizontal wavelength. Well, this is actually the horizontal, let's see. Beta over f max sine theta is the horizontal wavelength. And that has to be divided by 2. Now, if you want to image something at a certain depth, you don't just want an image at one point, right? Because you compare the image laterally. And so you want to make an image over an area. And to actually see something, you need to multiple times your Fresnel zone along the surface. So let's just say m is like 8 or 10 or something. So if you take that and multiply it by 2 times the Fresnel zone for your target at the maximum depth you want, divided by delta x, that tells you how many instruments you need to put out in your seismographics, in your seismic array. And so if we do 1 hertz, and we want to image the transition zone, and we want to see it over a large distance, this number gets impossibly big. I mean, it's like the only people who have that many instruments are the Chinese. And they actually do have like up to 1,000 broadband now, or they're getting there. But for doing typical crustal or upper mantle type surveys, if you have between 50 and 100 instruments, you can look at 5-second period or a 3-second period down to transition zone depth, and have a broad enough aperture that you can make an image of interest. Okay, so synthetic example. Okay, so I did this for the Capwell seismic experiment. I'm going to show you some results from that. But I've got a 15-second period in here, and I put in 3-point scatterers at 300, 400, and 660. The 400 and 660 are obvious. The 300 is because we were looking to see if we could see the base of the lithosphere. You know, the tectosphere is supposed to be 200-300 kilometers deep under the craton. And what these things are diffraction hyperboloids from these point scatterers. So this is the travel, both the travel through time and the amplitude curve for these three things. And this one, has, you can see, has a negative phase relative to that one or that one. These are positive, and the one I put at the 300, it has a negative. And one of the interpretations of this diffraction integral that we're using is that it sums over, at any point in the subsurface, it sums over a bunch of hyperboloids. So for every point in the subsurface, there's a different hyperboloid. So basically, the interval is just going along summing. Most of the time, it hits 0. When it goes along there, there's an event. And it takes that sum and it collapses it back. And it also gets one here, and it gets one here, and it doesn't get one anywhere else. OK, so this is what the image of the subsurface looks like. Well, it was a center period of 15 seconds, so it went from about 7 seconds to about 30. And you can see that you recover the point, the negative point, the positive point, and the positive point very well. And you can see that this one's a little smaller, this is a little bigger, and this is a little bigger. And these images are telling you what your resolution is when you look at them, because they are a depth image, and the wavelength stretches to accommodate or to correspond to the velocity model. So you basically see the resolution. Now, these don't look so good, right, because they have all of this stuff. And that's why I plot black and white and not color, because in color you can make these things go away and they look much prettier, and in black and white you always see what the noise is. Has anybody ever seen a color ultrasound image of a fetus? They don't do them. And the reason they don't is because you see more in black and white. It's not because the people in medicine don't have enough money for color. Okay, so now I take lateral slices through those because I want to show you what the lateral resolution is, because the whole idea behind this migration is to improve lateral resolution. And so these are what are called the point spread functions for these three points. And this one's at 300 kilometers. And you can see I'm showing two examples where I migrate up to different dips. The higher the dip, the better the fidelity of the image. This is at 300, this is at 410, and this is at 660. And what you can see, if you look at the amplitude scale, is the first thing is I captured the relative amplitudes correctly. I put in the correct perturbation for the 410 and the 660, and this ratio is correct. And the ratio between the negative one, which is minus 2.5, and these two other two is correct. So the amplitudes are correct. The other thing that's to note is that the resolution is actually pretty good. If you take the half width here, it's about 35 kilometers, and that corresponds to about lambda over 2. So in the case of perfect data, synthetic data, you can recover this at about lambda over 2. Now, you see this high frequency stuff up here, and this high frequency stuff here? Here I've migrated up to 70 degrees, and if you migrate up to 70 degrees at these depths, some of the energy in here is aliased, and this is what aliased energy looks like. So if you only migrate up to 40 degrees, nothing's aliased, and you get a much smoother thing. So your main lobe is pretty well defined, and then your side lobes are kind of small, and the main lobes are very big relative to the side lobes. So it's got a good point response. So the most important thing, and this is something that Guy said the other day, and that is data redundancy. You really want to have a lot of data. If you make an image from one earthquake at one array, it's going to not look good. So you want lots and lots of events and lots of receivers, and your data redundancy is just the product. And it turns out that this is a well-known phenomenon in summing signals and random noise, that the more events you have, is that your signal noise improves as the square root of the number of your sum. So if you have n events times n receivers, that gives you...
Yeah, only if your sources are independent.
Only if your sources are independent. I'll argue with you about that, but we'll do it some other time. And also, this is only for random noise, and unfortunately, much noise in seismic data is not random, it's organized. Organized noise, that's like rock bands. Yeah. Sorry, I'm a rock aficionado, but I couldn't help that. Okay, so other considerations. You have to have a very good starting model. And the good ones are the good travel time tomography models of the upper mantle. And the global models are better than the regional ones because the regional models are overdamped and they don't have an absolute velocity associated with them. They're just fluctuations. And then you need to do some data preconditioning. You take out the DC component of your data. You do some filtering. You take out the direct wave because you don't want to image it. And you can also wave number filter. And wave number filtering is frequency wave number type filtering, and it's a very dangerous thing to do. When the geologists in the oil industry have this joke where they say to the geophysicist, you know, what do you think's down there? And the geophysicist says, what do you want to be down there? Well, the way they do that is they use frequency wave number filters, and you can change the dips of events and all sorts of things. So I thought I'd go through a few examples. And the first one is from the Southern Rocky Mountains down here. Ken Duker put out an array of seismographs right here and provided me with his tomography model and his receiver functions, actually. And I took his receiver functions and made an image that looks like this. And, okay, it goes down to 200 kilometers. It's about 200 kilometers across. So the real good imaging depth here is about 125 kilometers. It is about down that deep. this zone of white stuff right here, these are the multiples. It's been filtered so that you have 3 seconds data. The instruments across here were 12 kilometers apart, so they're pretty close together. And then superimposed on the top, I've got a reflection survey, the results of a reflection survey and a refraction survey. So the reflection survey is this orange stuff and this pink stuff here. And what we saw was this big thrust belt in the subsurface and a suture zone coming in from the other direction. And then there were some modern basalt sills, which are these yellow things here. And then there's a volcanic field right up here at the surface that runs along here. And this thing is less than 1 million years old. Heat flow across here is about 200 milliwatts, it's above 100 milliwatts per meter squared and gets as high as 200 milliwatts per meter squared, which is higher than any conductive geotherm that doesn't melt the crust. So it's not a steady state geotherm. The MOHO and the receiver function images is this white line right here. And the MOHO and the refraction data is the blue line right there. The MOHO and the reflection data is where the reflections die out. So the MOHOs are agreeing within a couple kilometers all across the section. And when we get underneath the MOHO, we get these big black things. And these big black things are actually bigger in amplitude than the white MOHO. White means is a positive, and that means you're going from a fast velocity to a slow velocity. Black means you're going from a slow velocity to a fast velocity. And these black things are bigger in amplitude than the white. From the refraction data, we know the upper mantle velocity is about 7 3/4 kilometers per second, which is indicative of 1% partial melt if you use some standard scaling relations. And so, and if you look at the tomography anomaly, Ken's tomography anomaly looks is just this blob that sits right under here and extends off down to the north and it has some tendrils down here, and there's some more down things down here. But I just took, yeah, it's a low velocity blob. It's 3%. This is the 3% contour. It goes up to 4% in the middle. And so what we think these are is a series of sills that are melt impregnated, and that this is a melt production region that's feeding the volcanics up here. And the reason that we're getting large negative anomalies rather than positive is because when you go into a sill, you have high Q. So the S wave is, the P wave is not affected much, but the converted S wave is affected a lot. And when you go out of the sill, you get a conversion that's less sensitive to that. And so we would just say there's a whole zone of melt production, or at least low velocity, alternating low and high velocities that extend down to 125 kilometers. Well, I know where the multiples occur because I can model them. I can also see them in the record. What do you mean? I can finite difference forward model it. Yeah, I can ray trace it. Pardon me? Yeah, I know, but I have an excellent crustal model because I have a refraction data set.
It has a 2D model. Scattering is
trivial. That kind of scattering is not really very serious. I don't think these are multiples. So this would be, this zone here, at least somewhere, is a zone of melt production, we think. And that's what's produced both these sills up here and the basalt flow along there. So I want to go back now and look at, let me run back here. This is the Restro ray, which was run by Rick Astor and Ann, who was? Yeah. So this was a fairly big array. What was nice about it was an absolutely uniform array, 18 kilometer station spacing, goes from West Texas up into the central Colorado Plateau. And let me run through here. And they did this, this is also migrated with a diffraction integral of the kind I described. And this is the high frequency crustal image, and it shows the MOHO very nicely at a little bit over 40 kilometers, and it thins under the Rio Grande Rift. Rio Grande Rift is right here. And it runs down and gets a little bit thicker, still below 50 kilometers, as you go into the Great Plains. And then they see some very faint events under there, which they think may be associated with low velocity zones. Again, I disagree with you. And we can discuss that later. So, and if you look at it happened that there's a big active source profile right along there, and we saw on this part of the active source profile, we saw a low velocity zone right in where they see these what they're calling subcrustal discontinuities. Now, if you look a little bit deeper, this is the same data, but it's lower filtered with a lower pass filter, and goes from 200 to about 800 kilometers depth. And the 410 is relatively flat under this region, and the 660 is also relatively flat. The Rio Grande Rift is between 25 and 30, and this is probably multiples in here, which is unfortunate. These multiples are a problem. And but what this says is that all the processes associated with the Rio Grande Rift, which is crustal rifting and uplift of a broad part of the western U.S., are not being influenced by the upper mantle below the 400, because you would expect the 400 to be depressed if there was something hot coming up through it, and you would expect the 660 to be elevated. So it seems as though it's an upper mantle process. Okay, I wanted to show the Capwell craton. This is an experiment done by the Carnegie and MIT groups, and they put out this enormous array, which went from Cape Town up into Zimbabwe, and had reasonably dense station spacing along here. They had about 45 instruments. They put them out twice, which posed some problems. And it crosses the Capwell craton and the Bushveld complex, and then into this second craton up here. And down here, this is a Proterozoic folded belt. So the aperture is about 20 degrees, or about 2,000 kilometers. We looked at 9 earthquakes. One of the things I wanted to mention was, the other day somebody asked me, did I do 2D or 3D, and I said I did 2.5, and I wasn't being funny. That's actually an approximation. And the 2.5D approximation is if your waves are within about 30 degrees of this line, and you can approximate the structure as being roughly constant or orthogonal to your line, you can actually just migrate your data off of the whatever line it comes in on onto a plane. So you can use events from different azimuths and you just migrate them in and then superimpose them. And that actually works really well. Okay, so this is the image. And there's some good things about the image and some bad things about the image. The bottom is the Carnegie Group's tomography. And the first thing is Capwell Craton has this blue patch here and it has this red patch here. And I left off the velocity scale, but this blue patch is like plus a half percent. This is the P velocity. And this red patch is minus a half, so really tiny velocity variations. And the S velocities are only about 3 times as big. So you go from about plus or minus 1.5%, which are really small fluctuations. Makes me wonder about the tomography. And the other thing that's interesting is these things go through the different transition zone phase boundaries. Like this blue one goes right through the 660, and this red one goes right through the 410. And that's a little curious. Okay, so the image itself, these are the multiples. The crust under the Capwell craton is about a little bit over 30 kilometers thick, and the multiples are entirely predictable, and you see that right here in this white band, followed by this black band. Those are the two multiples that are strong. You don't actually see the crust because the instruments are too far apart. As you go into the Proterozoic mobile belt here, the multiples are degraded a little bit because the crust is changing thickness. You see the 410 really clearly, particularly under the craton, and you see the 660 really clearly, particularly under the craton. And then there's some stuff floating along at about 520 that comes and goes, or in the zone of the 520, which comes and goes. Now the 410 is the relative amplitudes between the 410 and the 660 are about correct for the global models. And but the thicknesses are different. The 410 actually is narrower than the 660 under here. The depth migration stretches the wavelet to match the velocity model. So you would expect the 660, which has a higher velocity, is going to have a broader wavelet. If you take that out just by measuring the width of the pulse and comparing it to the 410, you find that the 660 down here is about 1.3 to 1.5 times broader than the 410, which is a little bit unusual. The other thing that's really interesting are these patterns under the craton. You get these reflectors, or converters rather, which have a kind of wormy appearance. And, you know, ordinarily you might say, well, that's probably noise. But it's pretty stable. If you downsample your data, it doesn't go away. And if you look at the scale, they're actually pretty big. Like, remember that image I showed you at the beginning of the snorkel profile? That's only a few hundred kilometers across, that whole section. And these things are a few hundred kilometers across. So I think actually what we're seeing is some signature beneath the craton here. And this could be, if you look at peridotites, some of the peridotites from the base of the craton are very sheared, and this could be the sheared zone of the craton. The other nice reason to plot in black and white is because you see the migration noise. You see all this stuff going up like that and coming in like this? That is basically identifies where I stop, what angles I stop migrating. Oh, and this, Feng Lin Nu did a nice receiver function. He took the same receiver functions and he did this fourth root stacking, which really sharpens up the 410 and the 660, and CCP stacked them, and they just fit exactly nicely where the migrated images are. And in fact, they even fade in and out in the same places that the migrated image fades in and out. So that's kind of a consistency check. And you can see where the multiples are and so on. This is a by now really well-known result that Michael Bostock did using the generalized radon transform method. And this is from the Cascadia subduction zone. And the data were collected by John Nabeluk back in, the early 90s. And he put out a station every 5 or 10 kilometers over a distance of hundreds of kilometers. So you can imagine the field effort that went into collecting that data set. But Michael and his student, Stefan Rondinet and Dan Schrag, used this generalized radon transform method to make an image of the subduction zone under Cascadia. So this is supposed to be the thermal profile. So temperature shown here. And this is S velocity perturbation between -5 and +5. So you have, here's your oceanic crust, which appears between two high velocity perturbations. That's low velocity. And as you go down, it eclogitizes, starting around 60 kilometers, and becomes actually not much of a perturbation at all. It's just kind of neutral compared to the background model. And that's kind of interesting. You see that. You can see the multiples of the slab coming in down here. The real interesting story is that here they see the continental MOHO. You have negative over positive. And as you get up towards the volcanic zone or the Cascades, it actually goes away. And let's see, there's an inversion where you get in here where you get low over high, and they interpret that as being, or high over low rather, and they interpret that as being the mantle wedge that's been serpentinized. And the serpentinization has gone to the point where it's reduced the velocity of the upper mantle below the velocity of the crust, and that causes the velocity inversion. And they published this in a kind of how to do it paper in 2001 and then a Nature paper in 2002. Okay, so should I stop here? I have one more example, and I have a last bit of theory. But the theory's so cool. Okay, so this one, I hesitated about this because this is a work in progress. And this is looking at the Japanese subduction zone. And we're looking along this profile, A prime here. And the plate's subducting like this, and these are the contours of plate depth. So 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, and 600. And then the contours are the tomography anomalies in between the transition zones. So there's a big positive anomaly right under southwestern Japan, which is which has been interpreted as the transition zone full of subducted slab, the whole transition zone filled up with it. And right now we only have 6 earthquakes, and I'm afraid that's all we're going to get. So this was this is what we did this model for, and so I showed you this earlier, and it shows that even with a good 1D model, you can get a nice image of the slab. And the problem is you get a lot of noise, and the noise comes in the form of slab multiples. And presumably, if you stack enough events, if you have enough events at enough distant ranges, those will all stack out. And the problem is we can't do custom earthquakes. You know, we just have to live with what we get. And so usually they're not going to stack out. And if your velocity model, if you have a good 1D model, you get a slight mismatch about where the slab is. So these are the CCP, both linear and fourth root stacks from this zone, and it's shown with a tomography model, which I'll talk about in a second. And you get the 410 really nicely, and you get the 660 really nicely. And 660 is higher oceanward, and it's lower continentward. It's depressed a little bit. 410 seems to rise up a little bit, but you don't see much that looks like a slab. I mean, there's kind of a gray haze here, and there's a thing here. And the reason for this is that CCP stacking favors horizontal things. It does not favor things that are dipping. And the fourth root one is even worse. Here you just get blotches, but you get really nice sharp discontinuity. And the slab is supposed to be right in here. So you see there's kind of a crease here, and that crease is your CCP stack of the slab. So why did I put this in? So this is the velocity model. This is the start of a velocity model, and this was from Daipeng Zhao. And he actually took the earthquakes and fit a hard line here when he did his tomography. So the top of the slab is constrained by other data, and which makes it gives it a hard edge. So the slab is right here, and it only goes down to about 400 kilometers because that's where the earthquakes stopped there. And he was looking at phases that went up here, and you can see where his coverage is. The earthquakes basically define where you have a tomography model. And then Foucault has a global model, and has the transition zone filled with fast material, 1.5 to 2% VP fast, and then the slab looks sort of like this. So I took the two models and I blended them and smoothed it. And the image is not a great image, but it actually does show the slab from the top to the bottom. So you can see a phase that runs through here and runs down here and stops there, and you can actually see the bottom of the slab here and through there. And the 660 has got a little irregularity, and if you look at the synthetics, so do our synthetics, and that's from not knowing the velocity well in there. The 410 doesn't show up real well, but it does appear to have a bump through there. And you don't see it? Barbara, you need to come up here and stand on the side. You look down these things. As I said, I don't think it's a great image. This is the image without anything on it. This has the seismicity. You can see an event here, and you can see an event here. You can see an event there. You see this thing here, and a couple events there. 660, you agree to, right?
But you can do it only if you know in advance.
That's pretty much the way all seismic imaging works, right? You could do it, let's see, I could do it another way. I could, if you randomize the data, you don't get this out. How's that? I don't know how else to explain it. This is the tomography model. The tomography model agrees pretty nicely with the top of this line here. The seismicity agrees with it very nicely, except when you get down below about 200 kilometers and the seismicity starts going into what you would call the center of the slab. Pretty much like we saw yesterday. So, as I said, that's a work in progress, and there's only 6 earthquakes. You really need a lot more earthquakes. But as a start, you can see the top of the slab here. It disappears a little bit in here. You see the bottom of the slab here. The Japanese have subsequently gone and identified the bottom of the slab several other places and have papers in press on that. You can see the 410 kind of deflect upward here, if you believe it. I'm not entirely satisfied with that. Yeah? Well, these are those slab multiples. Oh. This thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Philippine Sea plate.
No.
You mean this?
Yeah.
I don't know. Who knows what that is? I think this is the base of the lithosphere. This could be heterogeneity above the slab that I don't take into account. I mean, I'm identifying continuous things. The tomography says there's a slab there. These correspond with it in space, and I know it's not a random signal. Oh, good question. Requires a long answer. How about if I talk to you later? I can show you the synthetics, and what you saw in the synthetics is they're about the same strength. Yeah. I'm trying to remember if I did any signal enhancement on this to amplify things with depth, which would be one reason that they might be stronger, but I don't think I did. I don't think I did any enhancement at all. Right here? To the right. This? Edge effect. Right, you're not illuminating this whole box equally. So when you see stuff like this, those are edge effects coming in from the side of the image. Most of the energy that is producing a nice signal is coming from from this direction and not from that direction. Pardon me? Well, it could be. Okay, so actually the box I image goes out to here and goes over to there. And the seismograph array stops there. Okay, so, and most of the energy that's making a picture is coming from this way. So the image gets smeared back this way. You see how there's a hole here? Okay, and that's an edge effect there. So these are both edge effects. Anything else? Yeah? So basically you're saying dip filter and then migrate.
I would say you look at the image at 50 feet because this flat interface at 30 degrees, the energy primarily towards the, I would say toward the, if you do a potential around 400.
You know, I've thought about doing that. The problem is whenever you start restricting the angle domain, that's applying one of these frequency wave number filters. And I mean, if I wanted to have a continuous slab, I'd put a frequency wave number filter and you guys would see something that just really stood out. And you can also selectively migrate certain angles and not others. And I'm not comfortable doing that because the idea is you capture the entire field and the diffractions create the diffractions collapse to create, you know, a coherent image. If you just take part of it, you start producing lateral smearing. If you take part of it in this angle domain, you get lateral smearing that way. If you take part of it in this angle domain, you get lateral smearing that way. Part of this is in your tutorial this afternoon. So you guys don't have to believe this. I'm still working on it. I'm trying to get more earthquakes. And that's enough. So thanks. Okay, so from the cross-section we're looking at is right here. And Feng Lin did receiver function CCP stacks along this line and along this line to look at the depth of the transition zone. And all of these dots on here are the seismograph stations. So there's a huge number of seismograph stations. And their average spacing is about 10 kilometers, a little bit less than 10 kilometers, and the aperture is about 1,400 kilometers.
This is the part of the slab that is comfortable.
Yeah, I agree. And we thought that this distance right here would look straight enough on the contours that we could approximate it as, you know, as a fairly smooth surface.
My thinking is that this blue cloud is really in the even point
slice. Yeah, I don't know. You could be right about that, but this is the slice from Foucault's model along along that transect AA prime. So this, that is not, I mean, one would not think that that is from the other trench, right? I mean, that looks like continuous slab.
Well, depending on where the cross-section is, if you take a east-west cross-section, first corner,
you mean like right here? Well, it could be why our image, you know, we see something very clearly down at 660, and we see something
right.
In the upper part, and then there's
that's
a, right. So you would choose, I don't know, it looks pretty continuous to me. So you would, like this all looks like one nice event to me. And what worries me is this part in here, because you're coming down, you see a polarity change in here, it goes to positive, and then there's this kind of complication. And right at that depth, I think it's hard to make sense out of the picture, and I just assume I've got a poor image at this point. But you would say that this thing is not...
The real clear part of that thing is 600 to the left edge, really at
it's coming from entirely different subduction zones. So that means we see three subduction zones, because we also see the Philippine sea plate in here. Okay. Well, that's possible. Any others? Sure. No, I said that 3D multiples are not important. I didn't say 3D effects were not important. Well, okay, so the first order of the Earth is layered. Does everyone agree with that? Where do the big velocity fluctuations occur? 410, 660, and the MOHO. What's the biggest? The MOHO. Okay, the first order of the MOHO is relatively flat, right? It varies from 10 to... it varies by about 10 kilometers over the continents. It varies much less over the oceans. Okay, your multiple field is primarily influenced by that layer. So you have to have something as strong as the MOHO aimed sideways to produce a multiple that's important from in the outer plane. So if you, and you can do that if you have like a really big mountain route, right? So you have, you know, something that it's got a big mountain route, and it'll focus the multiples back, but it'll focus them into the center of the mountain range. Pardon? There you need to do 3D, I agree. I mean, that's what I plan to do on my sabbatical. So. You can sort of draw it a, let's see how to, yeah, okay, so you have these hyperbolic surfaces. Okay, they're actually hyperboloids. So you just rotate it in space. And
right.
Yeah, and they get larger as you go down. Go down, right. Yeah, I don't disagree that. Well, I think that 3D is very important, actually, and I mean, with the US Array data, we're going to have to do 3D things. And in interesting tectonic regions, you have to do 3D things. Computationally, it's really expensive, and but not terrible. I mean. Yes. No, and that's normally the case, right? I mean, when we go out and do Pascal experiments, normally you have one dense array, and then you have some other stations scattered around. That's what people do. And in places like, you know, the Himalayas, I think that's a great approximation. If you go normal to the Himalayas, it's 2D. And Michael Bostock's result, I think, is really good because you're normal to the Cascades. That's a 2D structure. Yeah, this one's a little dicier. Maybe we should look at Michael's more. People can talk about it. Yeah. Informally, I mean, I don't do the formal bootstrap because each of the migrations and assembly takes hours. What I do is I just start dropping events and dropping traces randomly. The other thing I do is a random noise test. So I do a completely random field that's bandpassed to the same as a signal, and then I migrate it, and that'll show me what imaging artifacts are in the array and the earthquake distribution. So you can see places where you expect streaks, and you can use that as a benchmark. And now I've done it with the cap vol. The HEMA is actually, the array is so regular, I didn't think it was necessary. Anything else? Yes? No, actually, okay, they do use other phases. They use the PPS, they use the PETA S and the PPS and the SPS. Anyway, that whole combination of phases. And that gives them a really nice MOHO. However, they don't suppress the multiple because the multiples come in below 120. So they just cut off their image. And all the multiples will appear down here if you migrate them. See, what they do is they just, they take, the wave field, and they migrate it with the correct travel times for P to S. Then they take the wave field and they migrate it with the correct travel times for P to S to P to S, and they go through iterative like migrations, and then they sum the images. But they never actually get down to where the multiples would interfere with the upper mail. Yes? The velocity model is really important. Yeah. Okay, this is perfect data. This is synthetic. But this is the slab model, but then I migrated it with a, well, I didn't migrate it. Sangwon Ham migrated it with a, 1D, just a 1D velocity model with no slab at all, and you get back the slab. It's just mispositioned a little bit. That's part of your tutorial. It turns out, I was surprised by this. I would have thought that the waves coming in from this side would convert nicely at the base of the slab and produce a pretty good signal. But in fact, they're coming in almost, so close to normal that they don't do much S conversion. And the waves that produce a nice signal are coming actually up the slab. And when they come up the slab, they have other complications. So the noise field gets quite strong because you get these waves that rattle around inside the slab and then leak out again. So if you have a bunch of events on the landward side rather than the oceanward side, you can get a nice picture. If you image just from the oceanward side, you don't.
Left. So what would we make to see? Is to take the same data and to apply to them various things?
CCP stacking and yeah, actually, that's hopefully this workshop is a series of three that NSF funded for Earthscope, and part of the goal is to do just that. We want to compare all the methods, find out what's real and what's noise, and use different all the different methods and different pre-processing schemes.
Complicated calculation, then he applied something very, very primitive. He got exactly the same. Is there a real reason to do it?
Or are we just doing it because we like to burn up computer time? There's always that possibility. Well, okay, so I didn't actually show that many comparisons with receiver functions, but I did show you a synthetic example, and this is just a straight CCP stack with a correct 1D velocity model of the slab. So it does not recover the dipping structures very well, and it makes the image very blurry, and in fact, that's what we see in the field data receiver functions. In Ken Duker's receiver functions from New Mexico, you know, you see all this stuff down there, but it's not very coherent. So, I don't know, maybe we're just burning up computer time off. It's possible. Yes? Yeah. Velocity model. Yeah. And well, in fact, Michael Bostock's method is 1D. It uses a 1D velocity model and gets a remarkably good picture, considering that you have a slab there, right? I mean, there's no slab in that velocity model. Stan?
You showed that you could do a synthetic 25-4-meter scatter.
Uh-huh.
As I remember.
Yeah.
Is there actually a hope of recovering information about random 25-4-meter scatters?
Do you want to do the tutorial? No. Well, because I said you could, when I said you could see things about 10 kilometers, and that's based on a 3-second wavelength. Generally, 3-second energy in receiver functions is pretty coherent. When you get a little bit higher, the scattering because of the surface and heterogeneities in the crust gets larger. But 3 seconds is a pretty stable frequency. And in the upper mantle, that's got a wavelength of a little under 15 kilometers. So lambda over 2 is 7.5 kilometers.
I mean, I understand if you put in 25 kilometers, you can see it.
Yeah.
But if you put a bunch in to what's already incredibly noisy, I assume you have to imagine how things are. I mean, I can't imagine how much it would have to have happened and then you have to do it in the background.
That's a good point. Let me show you this image. Well, these are layers, they're not individuals. I mean, I think that's layered. Okay, you will agree that I think that both of these are pretty smooth images. Wouldn't you say? And you can see things like right there that are isolated. And they're, how big? You know, like 10 kilometers by 20 kilometers.
almost mimics the NOHO.
Yeah.
And then learning how to see things the way you guys do.
Well, you have to have a lot of imagination, yeah. Well, okay, so one of the things I know about this migration is, like the tomography models, they use a lot of regularization. And what does regularization do, class? It smooths things, yeah. And that's why they get such a nice smooth NOHO. So I would say the fact that these things are not connected, even though you've tried to make everything laterally continuous, suggests that they really aren't, that they're little blobby things. Now, can you interpret those and not risk the criticism of your skeptical peers? That's a different question entirely. I think you need multiple lines of evidence right now to prove anything. That's why we show the model, the tomography model and the image together to try and see correspondences. You know, this is like new to global seismology, and I expect a healthy amount of skepticism, but only a healthy amount. Anything else? I think we're into the break time.